Under the skin. All right, hello and welcome to Under the Scales. The Under the Scales mobile studio has moved again. Otherwise, I wouldn't say mobile. It has moved to just north of my house, which is in Princeton, New Jersey, to what town is this? Is this Ringo's?
Technically, Hopewell.
Hopewell, New Jersey.
On the cusp of being Ringo's.
On the cusp of being Ringo's.
Just outside of Princeton.
So I'm with Tebow, Stephen Thomas, whom you guys know, and I'm also with Scott. But it's a different Scott than you've met before. First, you met Scott Gray. This time is a Scott that you guys know, but you don't know that you know. And his name is Scott Herman. Scott Herman is a co-writer of many songs. And we're gonna do sort of a Q&A episode, but we're also going to explain kind of Scott Herman to you guys, which is more of an undertaking than you might think. Anyway, hi, Tebow. How are you?
Good.
And hi, Scott. How are you?
Apparently confused.
You're confused? One of the very first things that we realized was Scott Herman was mentioned in a Northampton show recently by Trey. It was a Trey Acoustic. It was the first of the Trey Acoustic shows this...
This spring.
This spring. Yeah, March in Northampton. It was the first of his three. And in the middle of the show, you guys might remember he asked me for lyrics to Steam, and I was unable to come up with them.
Hey, Tom, what's the next line? Tom Marshall, ladies and gentlemen.
But I think before that, before I sort of fumbled that situation, Trey had drawn everyone's attention to the fact that Scott Herman was in the audience. And Scott, do you remember what song had just preceded his announcement?
I don't know, it was kind of in the middle of the show, it seemed like.
I think he just knew that...
He'd already played a couple of songs that we had co-written.
Yes.
Discern and...
Oh, Discern, that's right.
I can't remember exactly which ones he did in the order, but he did some more after, but...
It was shaping up to be a pretty good Scott night. And Trey, as we know, will subtly do that, because I had told him the day before that you were going to be there. And so I think he probably pulled some of those out for that purpose. But anyway, it was very nice. He said something to the effect of, ladies and gentlemen, just want to let you know, someone who doesn't necessarily like to be in the spotlight at all is here tonight, and it's Scott Herman. And so I thought that was very nice.
And he's here tonight, too.
But what Scott just told me tonight was that might have been the first time he got called out from stage. So that was pretty
cool. I'm shouting somebody out right now. This is so important to me. This is the most important thing of the whole night. Okay? There's, like I was saying about, there's so many songs, and songwriting for me has always been a joyous, like, hangout, fun party experience. So many songs were written with so many different people. Many with Tom, many with Steve, with my friend Susanna, with the guys in the Fish guys, with many other friends. I started thinking about it this morning. There's probably like 20 or 30 people who co-wrote, because anybody that's in the room is in. You know, like if we start writing a song, if you're in the room, you get the songwriting credit. But there's one person that is so important to the Fish community that does not get shouted out enough. And that person happens to be in the audience right now. And for this person, I'm sorry I'm embarrassing you, because he's a very wonderful, smart, brilliant, amazing person who is also not big on probably being in the spotlight, but he's about to be, because I want you guys to shout him out. But a lot of these songs were three-way kind of written with Tom and myself and this guy. And the next song we're going to play, which is Heavy Things, was one of them. The other ones that he was a co-writer on were Limb by Limb, Undermined, Verses of the Meat Stick, a lot. And his name is Scott Herman, and he's here tonight. So could you please give him a big...
Prior to that, Scott, Tebow, and I had done a reunion summer of 2016, and we went to the Great Woods in Massachusetts and the Hartford, Connecticut show. And the reason we did that was because the three of us used to go to a lot of fish shows together, including Clifford Ball, The Great Went, It. Chime in here, fellas.
Oswego,
yeah. And we got RVs together. We did all that stuff. So anyway, we're the Three Musketeers, and we're now in a room together. And I want to kind of explain a little bit about Scott's and my history. But they also want to ask me some questions. Do you guys want to start with a question?
How involved are you currently in the songwriting process with Fish / Trey / Scott? How often do you guys still get together to write?
Well, okay. It's a good question because Trey, we go on and off. Trey's got so many projects. He has Tab, he has Fish, he has classical stuff. And so just even getting a songwriting weekend scheduled is impossible. And you have to do it through management now. And it's a big deal. We had sort of a once per year, 10 songs per year kind of commitment to ourselves. And if you look over 32 years, we probably do have 320 songs. So that's, we're sticking to
easily.
It. So most recently, we just wrote at the Jersey Shore a couple months ago. And the song that immediately came out of that people heard is Everything's Right, which Trey debuted at the...
Capitol Theater.
Right, at the Capitol Theater on Tab Tour. And look into the eyes of everyone you meet. Try not to step on your best friend's feet. The line is in the sand, the flag is planted. The rest of your life, don't take it for granted. Cause everything's right, so just hold tight. Everything's right, so just hold tight. Everything's right, so just hold tight. Just hold tight. As far as Scott, Herman and I, well, we always had a different... Scott, you and I had a different approach entirely. A lot of our songwriting success came from being together in close proximity. Do you want to start, like, tell a little bit about the genesis of our songwriting?
Well, I guess it started... Actually, it was probably 1989 or sometime when we were both working together at AT&T. And we didn't really work together. Like, we weren't on the same projects or anything, but we had some mutual friends, which kind of brought us together in the same sort of lunch crowd.
Right.
You know, so we started to get to know each other just because of that. And our communications for a while were just, you know, these emails between, and when I say emails, there was no internet per se,
in the building.
It was just my server to your server that were sitting there, these Unix servers that we use for doing our project work. And Unix mailed between each other, and it was mostly about what time is it? Are we ready to go to lunch yet? Where are we going to lunch today? That kind of stuff. And one day, out of the blue, I got this email from Tom that said, "The squirming coil of sunset I keep from Satan's reach. Tried yesterday to get away and hitchhike to the beach." And yes, he put the word Satan in. I'm not responsible for that. I just want to make that clear right now.
Pretty good start.
And I looked at that, and I didn't really know how to respond. And my friend Ron, mutual friend of ours, happened to be in my cubicle at the time. And I
said, "Shout out Ron Cote."
Yeah. I said, "Ron, you know, I don't know how to respond to something." He goes, "Sure you do." So I thought about it for a few minutes, and then I wrote the rejoinder, which I guess is now the second part of the beginning of The Squirming Coil. Sent that back to Tom.
The squirming coil of sunset I keep within my reach. Tried yesterday to get away and hitchhike to the beach. I saw Satan on the beach trying to catch a ray. He wasn't quite the speed of light, and the squirming coil, he got away. Yeah, it got away.
Which I guess pleased him, and then from there, we kind of did that again and again many times, where we would write some short little couplet or maybe a verse, send it over, it would get expanded upon, we'd trade back and forth.
In a prior podcasting episode, I sort of discussed how you and I were in an ocean of cubes, so to speak.
Exactly.
And me more than you, certainly, because you were definitely one of the productive members of that society. But we kind of use this as a diversion from boredom, in all honesty. So I happen to be in a group that got a little less work, I guess, than Scott's. But also Scott, with some seniority, had more work because things would happen. Like, people would come by his office/cube and say, what do I do now? Or what is this? Blah, blah, blah. And Scott happened to know a lot about the system. If you were to come up to me and Scott today and ask what that system did, Scott would be able to tell you, and I would not.
I do not remember.
But in any case, Scott and I wrote so many things together that at one point, and I was very impressed, Scott printed out all our shit, all our creative stuff. He left out, of course, when are you going to lunch and all that stuff. But he printed everything out, and then we decided, you know, there's so many poems here, so many weird little things, that we decided to bind it. And how did that work out, Scott? What happened then?
Well, I took all of this context. It was basically all these emails, which I had in electronic form. We put them into a folder somewhere. I stuck them into like a Access database or something so that it was easy to sort of format them into a printed version.
Manipulate, yeah.
We printed it all out. I gave you a copy. You took it somewhere.
I mean, we're talking about 300, maybe 400 little poems.
We're talking about 300 or 400 pages.
Yeah.
And most of the pages had multiple poems on
them.
Yeah,
right, okay.
But a lot of it was crap, let's be honest. A lot of it was just drivel. But within that, I mean, you took it somewhere and made some copies of it, got it bound with a spiral thing, put a cover on it, named it, and it became the Salamander Prince.
The Salamander Prince.
Which,
so now this is important. So we got it bound by one of those spiral binding companies or whatever it was. Where I mean, this thing is a full inch thick.
You took it to Daubert, didn't you?
A full inch thick. Yes,
Black Father.
Black Father Mark Daubert, who is going to be a subject of a future podcast episode and features very much into the history of fish, was working at Kinko's at the time, and he bound it for us. And basically, binding basically was making maybe 5 copies or 6 copies. So there's total of 6 copies of this book, and then punching these weird sort of multiple rectangular holes in the binding, and then putting one of those plastic kind of claw bindings in. And so this was a very many page book, and Scott and I found this bizarre photo, I think, of me, and Mark may have treated it like made it green or something. It looks sort of scary and green and amphibian-esque, and we called it the Salamander Prince from one of our poems. We gave it to Trey, and he went nuts. He like was off to the races. He used it, and if we only had his copy of it, there's a rumor that his copy of it still exists, that someone grabbed it and realized the value of it. He wrote almost on every single page, and he wrote notes, and he did stuff, and he wrote so many songs from it. And you know, some of the songs are like Rogay, and
that whole era.
Tell me some more, Scott.
Well,
like songs
early,
that came
I mean,
from it.
Chronologically, Lawn Boy,
yeah,
came from there. Cavern,
yeah.
Cavern was our
was in there.
That was our
but
masterpiece.
Probably everything that has a credit to me is in there, just about, except for some very recent ones.
Just cycle off a couple. I mean, my favorite song ever of yours, ever, is Meat Stick, and Trey and I in Austria wrote the chorus.
Chorus, yeah.
But you wrote everything else. And Trey,
that came a bit later, and that was
unsure if you are still Corinne, like probably the best line ever in Fish.
I'm trapped here as my senses bleed. I can't recall which things I need. You show up late and stone still Korean. My captive gaze inside your eyes. Reveal a thing you tried to hide. Attempting to record this tune. Reflections drive me out of you. Time for the meat stick. Bury the meat stick. Take out the meat stick. Time. Whoa, sharks my brain.
Basically, it became one of those things where Trey, when he was sitting around with the band and needed lyrics, would grab the Salamander Prince. And it was, he always called it, let's mine the Prince. When we didn't have lyrics, let's mine the Prince, meaning like open it up
just
and flip find,
it open and just yeah. find something. Put your finger on it, yeah. like a globe.
But
and
find something that hasn't been used good. Before, like, basically.
It's Ice and Rift. I mean, everything was in there.
It was the basis of so many songs. It was incredible. So if you guys happen to like Ghost look on BMI and like look through Fish's catalog, you'll find Scott credited with, I don't know, 30 songs or something. It's crazy how it happened.
Maybe 18.
And it's so fun. 18?
I don't know, somewhere.
What is it? Anastasio, Marshall, Herman? Or
yeah,
usually.
I think
usually.
So. Well, no, it's probably alphabetic.
Is it?
I don't know.
I don't remember. Yeah. I remember always looking.
Lennon, McCartney.
It varies. And sometimes the Herman's just left out altogether.
Right. Well, I know there's been a lot of Thomas left out.
Too. Well, I did leave Scott out in one that is particularly embarrassing to me is Squirm and Coil? No, Lawn Boy.
Lawn Boy's yours.
You didn't use the verse that he...
No, Lawn Boy was right. A response to something I wrote to you, but Lawn Boy is entirely yours.
Lyrically, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Right. Lawn Boy, yeah. The actual lyrics, throughout the night, when there's no direct light, and the thin veil of clouds keeps the stars out of sight, I can smell the colors outside on my lawn, the moist green organic my feet tread upon, and the black oleander surrounded by blues. I get so overwhelmed. By olfactory hues. That was a response to something you had sent me.
Yeah,
is that correct?
I can't remember the details of it, but it had to do with...
There was like clouds and night and, moonlight. Right. So for whatever reason, you got me thinking and it worked out perfectly. But the first part of the song didn't make it in to my embarrassment. But whatever. That happened a few times where, you know... But anyway, it was made up for by Meatstick, which was 99.9% Scott's lyrics, which are amazing. Hey, Scott, so The Prince became this tome. Almost, it is in a weird way. It is the helping friendly book of Fish. That attained some sort of mythical status, but Trey mined it so much that it was kind of exhausted. And I remember there was a songwriting session coming up, Trey and I had, and I said to you, Scott, we've written stuff since. Let's gather that, plus let's write another 40 songs. I made some, like, improbable kind of, milestone that we tried to reach.
Yeah.
And I think we did it, and we turned it into another book. Do you remember the name of that one?
Yeah, Walls of the Cave.
Walls of the Cave, right.
Which Walls of the Cave was in.
Walls of the Cave, right. Do you remember what songs from there... that you had parts in that made it into the current Fish canon?
Undermined, Friday, Sense and Subtle Sounds.
All the stuff from Undermined was was there.
Friday, that's right.
Waves.
Oh, yeah, Waves. Oh, Satellite. Is that called, what's that one called? Anything But Me.
Anything But Me, yeah.
I am just a satellite high above the atmosphere. Bouncing everything you say to someone who was meant to hear. Sometimes on a rainy day, I lie in bed and dream of you. So blame it on the satellite when your message can't get through.
All of those were in all those Walls of the Cave.
And that was
I think Pebbles and Marbles came out of there.
Oh, you're right. Are you a Pebbles and Marbles person?
No, I'm just saying these are songs that came from that second book. That second book had way, way fewer items
it
in
had
it.
Fewer items, but in a way, higher quality.
I love that you don't know what songs you've even written. hence why, like Trey asked you from the stage for Steam lyrics. You're like, I don't know. You looked at me like, Do you remember?
I looked at you like, why aren't you quickly Googling this? Right. I like,
or it just that goes back to the if you know could, it. I wrote it.
If you could show everyone the volume of crap that's in the prints,
yeah,
combined with Walls of the Cave or whatever, I think it would be more excusable to understand why. I don't remember all the lyrics to something that Trey picked out that we wrote in 1992.
Right.
So, a lot of people wouldn't even understand though, that, though.
He wrote it maybe 3 years ago, but it was written in 1992 and put into this volume.
Right. Funny thing, like, you know every single Beatles song, right? I don't know every single Fish song.
I don't know every single Tom song.
I don't even Scott know every song. Single, right. Yeah. So maybe we should learn.
We've been many places, many, many shows, and someone will inevitably come up to you and ask you something about a song or a lyric, and you'll be look at me or Scott and go, what's the next line? You just won't remember.
I remember somebody one time came to you and didn't know who you were, and you said, I'm Tom Marshall, and they asked you to prove it by reciting something which you couldn't do.
It was Julius, and you couldn't do it. You literally gave up right away, and they all looked at you like, oh, look at you bragging that you're someone that you're not. What a dummy.
Right.
And they walked away.
Well, I didn't get to meet them. Wow.
Yeah.
You know, wow. I'm so sorry.
That was a young Michelle and...
Barack Obama.
Barack Obama. I couldn't remember his name.
Barack. You can only remember the first lady Michelle. For some reason.
Well, she went to Princeton with me.
Okay.
She went to Princeton without you, decided without
well,
you.
Well, I was there at the time. I was living in Princeton.
Okay, right. You drove through Princeton when she was there. So, Scott and Tebow, you guys were involved in this thing that sort of has followed me around. Guys that work, the Fish crew.
Work hard.
They work hard, and they, you know, they deserve every penny they get, and I think they probably get a lot now. I don't know. They're probably doing very well. But anyway, the guys who, like, slog it out day in, day out through Fish. Fish's backstage, I have to say, has always worked like clockwork. I mean, it's phenomenal. And I don't really have anything to gauge it on, apart from what other people tell me when they come and they see Fish's backstage. And it's just, it's stellar. It is just immaculate. Everything works. They get shit up on time.
It's down to a science.
It's down to such an incredible science. And this is strange because it also has to, they have to merge and work with the local crew as well. So they know every venue by heart. They know where to hang every single piece of lighting, scaffolding. They know everything. But in any case, every now and then, something will fuck up this incredible clockwork. Someone will throw a mic at us.
And you never, ever want to be that person.
You don't want to,
ever,
be.
Ever,
right.
Ever.
It's a smoothly oiled machine, and all of a sudden, there's like this red
wrench, you know, thrown into the
wrench. And
Sandy
Tebow,
wrench.
Scott Herman, and I happened to provide the monkey wrench at one point, and... the way it happened was, this was a show in Albany. Do you happen to know when this was, Scott?
It had to be like 2000.
Okay.
And one, maybe,
so,
or something.
So, Scott's brand new Audi, 2001 Audi, is a 4 Series Audi, A4. Yeah?
Yeah.
Correct? And it was a brand new car, and we As drove up
we to... We often made Scott drive.
Yeah, Scott was a great designated driver.
He didn't trust us.
Scott has a built-in... What is the thing with you? It's like, you have a built-in thing, you can drink like 3 beers, and then you stop.
We don't have that.
We don't have
that. Yeah, I can't explain it. It's just...
It's your thing. It's your
alcohol starts to taste really bad after I've had, you know, 2 or 3 drinks in a short time period. It's just,
but we know how to break through
I
that.
I hate it.
Yeah. We break through it by more alcohol.
I can't do it.
We switch alcohols.
Even that doesn't work. I've tried it.
It's worse.
Anyway, so Scott is like a designated driver without, like, it's not a bad thing. He doesn't mind. So, you know, that's not why we had him along, though. Is it Tebow?
Well, no. Remember, he did write songs.
Okay. So. Oh, right. Okay. Okay, anyway.
Well, that's no reason to
take to the
him
story.
Along.
That's true. So at some point around 2001, maybe, in Albany, I of course, tried to get... You know, we probably drove around and looked for parking. We're probably a little too close. No,
we just went backstage.
Okay. I was going to say we're probably a little too close to showtime, and we wanted to, you know, ditch the car quickly and get to our friends and get to a bar, blah, blah, blah. And the very easy way at that time for us to do that was just flash Tom's All Access, and someone backstage will open the gates and let us in. And now Albany, it was a very strange venue where you actually had to kind of drive down a decreasing radius spiral ramp. And it's one of those things that's probably a bus or a truck can just barely fit down it. And we fucked that up by the guy said, yeah, you can park here, but you got to be... He probably said something to the effect of...
Didn't hear it. He said, park over there.
He said, park over there. But are you going to be gone? He didn't do anything.
No, I just remember parking, getting out, and I think we just went backstage. Or we went to a bar.
And now this is pre-cell phone. So now our car is sitting there in the very, very bottom of this...
There was a few other cars, you know, parked around there, whatever.
Right. But for whatever reason, our car is kind of in this keystone spot. And apparently, at the time, Fish probably, now they're like, I don't know. Now they have like 10 semis and 7 buses. But at the time, they were probably like 4 or 5 semis and 1 or 2 buses, a crew bus and a band bus, maybe more.
Maybe more by that.
Maybe point. More. But in any case, all those things were sort of in their right places, and our Audi was in the wrong place that prevented anything from moving around at all.
When the show ended, we went to hang out with some friends nearby, and everybody else who had parked in that area had grabbed their car and gone. So it was the only one car there. But in my defense, I know you've been blamed for this all along. I mean, they always...
Jersey drunk.
You about it. I think they know that it's my car or whatever, but they still blame you because you're the one who got us back there or whatever. But in my defense, I did walk... When we walked out the back way, and I asked someone... Now, I may have asked someone who didn't know what the hell they're talking about. It may have been a local person, local crew person, whatever. But I asked someone, is it okay to leave that there for a while, or do I need to move it somewhere? And I said, that should be okay.
Okay.
But it was in a corner somewhere where a truck that needed to get down and turn and back up to the loading dock couldn't do that.
Couldn't do it. So basically what happened in the ages of pre-cell phone was that the concert ended and Tebow Scott and I went and got drunk after the show in a bar in Albany. And we probably did a full hour.
Meanwhile, the band is trying, the crew is trying, and the union guys from the Knickerbocker Arena are trying to load out.
And they can't.
And the price is going higher and higher every minute over 11 o'clock that the union guys are sitting there.
They have to go. They probably go to double overtime and they probably don't care. They're probably
they want it.
They're probably thrilled. Like, oh, good. They can't get the trucks in. We don't have to do anything.
Audi's sitting there.
And the Audi's sitting in the middle of the whole thing. And so anyway, fast forward to Scott and Tivo and I decided to finally amble in and get our car. And we walk in and it's gone. Like, what's that all about?
Everything was gone.
Everything was gone. There was no car. There was... Everything was loaded out. Loadout was done. And...
because they are very efficient.
They're efficient. Once they get access to the stuff. So, I made the mistake. We should have, like, looked around the venue for your car. Because it was hidden, kind of. But basically what happened was, I walked in and I said, hey, does anyone know where... did anyone see like a silver Audi A4? And immediately someone like Haddon or Dickie just goes, it was Marshall. It was Marshall. Marshall. And I have not heard the end of it yet.
This is 17 years
ago. 17 years now. Someone will say, hey, you know,
hey, where
I'll
you parking
see,
tonight?
Yeah,
Tom.
I'll see someone backstage and they'll go, where'd you park? Where'd you park, Tom? And it was because of that. And I think probably it ended up costing Fish a whole lot of extra overtime with people. But basically what happened was the way that the ramp was and so, a flatbed couldn't even come down to get his car out. So they put these weird roller skates where they sort of wedged wheels under each of his four wheels. And strong men had to kind of like push the car up. And so they pushed it all the way around 180 degrees on the other side of the venue and kind of hit it in a lot. They told us later where it was, but they let us suffer for a little while.
Now, didn't you also have, after that, the very next tour, you know, the laminates are numbered, but your laminate said...
Oh, yeah, after that, I got punished that my laminate from then on said...
Jersey drunk.
The Jersey drunk.
With a picture of you. It was very elaborate laminate.
There was a little bit of punishment. Yeah. I mean, we'd already we've talked about how Fish, Fish the band punishes people.
There's always a...
Now the crew...
Once the anger's over,
yeah.
There's pranks involved.
Right. Now I'm open season for the crew, too.
Right.
So weird shit was starting to happen.
Going out of their way to make a laminate like that for you shows a certain amount of affection.
They love you.
Right.
All right. Next question.
All right.
What was the inspiration for the lyrics to the song Cavern?
Well, I think...
The time is near. The mission's clear. It's later than we think.
That line was really a response to the fact that you had just announced to me probably that day or the previous day that you had finally found someplace else you were going to go. You were leaving AT&T. So that was upsetting to me in some way, but I knew that you had been wanting to do that for some time. So to me, it was like, well, good. You found what you need to move on to. And that's what that first line was about.
Your time is near, the mission's clear. It's later than we think. Before you slip into the night, you'll want something to drink. Steal away before the dawn and bring us back good news. New tread and primal soup, please wipe it from your shoe. She's in a purple pirate school.
And after that, it's anybody's guess.
Well, we did. We sort of ventured into this character kind of swamping around through rivers and fields and fen and all kinds of stuff and, you know, using spines of warthog to puncture his you know, pressure within his palm. What happened to his palm? With handy spine of hedgehog,
he released the force
with it. It's because his palm had grown or something.
I don't know. You wrote that line.
You figured it out.
Right. That's why I don't know it is because I wrote it. Let's go to a different question because I think we've done the cavern thing pretty well.
Do you believe existence is a simulation?
Existence is a simulation. Kind of like The Matrix, right?
Sounds like, yeah.
All right, so... The Matrix people that are being used like to be human batteries are like fed these mental images to calm them down, kind of like a fake reality. So is that person asking me, do I think that everything I see right now is a fake reality and we're sort of being mined for our resources? Yes. Yes, I do.
Wow. I fell asleep. Sorry. I do have a question that I think pertains sort of to
you,
too.
That was a yes or no question.
The question is, when did you leave Scientology to start believing that?
All right. This goes to both of you. As a songwriter, what's your enjoyment level of the deep jams? Do you love them as much as some of the fans?
Scott, I see you sort of with your eyebrows down. I want to sort of explain what I think the question means, but then I want you to answer it. But basically, when I go to a show, I've had amazing, transcendent, wonderful moments during jams, of course. A whole lot, like when they start a song, I'm kind of like, all right, well, what's the next one going to be? And sometimes if they're 10 minutes...
You ask, which song is this again?
Yeah.
And which you've done 1,000 times.
Yeah, is this...
What song are we in?
Yeah, is this still Simple? Is this still Reba? But, you know, it's a happy question because I'm at Fish and I'm in my happy place. But in reality, I prefer a 20-song show than a 10-song show. How about you, Scott? That's, I guess, directed to you as well.
Yeah,
because it said songwriters.
Yeah. Well, I don't think songwriter should apply to me in any case. Lyricist, maybe slightly. But since I've never been able to play a musical instrument in my life and I'm... basically tone deaf and can contribute absolutely nothing to the musical portion of anything. Songwriter just always seemed misnomer. I'm probably in the same boat as you. I like
a large variety of songs. But I mean, there's times, and I guess the thing with jams is there's great jams and there's jams that are sleepy to me. So a great jam is a great thing, and I don't mind a 10-minute long version of something if it's something I can really kind of revel in. But on the whole, I kind of feel like, well, I'd like to hear a lot of different songs.
Because Fish playing,
I want them to keep moving on. I'm always hoping that they're going to play the thing I like best, whatever that is that week or that month or whatever.
Right.
I'm always looking for that to be the next song.
And there's, I mean, I have to assume everyone feels it, but there are certain songs I just don't like, and there are songs that I love. So
you admit there's a song you don't like in particular?
I'm sure there's probably a couple.
You have a problem with the song Foam. You really do.
I just don't like it. I'm sorry.
To be honest, I had to say this the same. And we might usually be sitting together. And if we're not sitting together, Foam would come on back in the day. I would go backstage to get a beer and Scott would be there. Or vice versa.
Right there with you.
In a way, that sort of became almost a part of it. It's like Foam was great in the sense that I know I'd find Tebow backstage. We could sit down, have a beer, chat for a little while the show's going on, minutes. And then go back out for the good songs.
So I would probably be ditched by you at that point, because I'm standing there knowing that the cool instrumental part of Foam is coming up.
Yeah, you were always out there.
Yeah, but to me, it's one of like Trey's, it's one of his best compositions. Sure, it really is. It's fantastic.
There's no argument there.
Yeah, yeah. It's an intelligently composed song.
I think a musician can appreciate that more, though, than someone who as right. I mentioned earlier,
it doesn't tweak your
totally
funny bone for whatever
musically
reason.
Inclined. Yeah. Right. So,
and similarly, I remember, you know, trying not to be offended when my band Amphibian was on stage, and this song that I wrote with my friend Matt and JP called Onion would come on.
Scott, let's go backstage and get a beer.
Before I make the change, and the onion turns to wax and drips into the drain, into the drain. Into the drain.
Offensive name.
It's just, you know, I didn't want it to make me cry.
Nice. Well done. Good cover. So, all right, hit me with more questions, fellas.
I have a question that it pertains to you two, but it's sort of an odd question, like, because I always wonder what it would be like to hear something you wrote on stage with 30,000 people screaming when the first notes hit and the lyrics hit, but with you guys, it was sort of gradual because a lot of your songs were in smaller venues and then they got bigger and bigger. But Scott, when you hear something that you've written, I always look at Tom when a new song comes out. Whenever you hear the song for the first time that started in a cubicle or just started somewhere at your computer or on vacation, you write something down and all of a sudden we're at a venue and there's 25,000 people screaming. And
as you were asking the question, I honestly kind of immediately just sort of went back in time and they were playing Bouncing Around the Room. Everyone sang, and I awoke.
Right.
And
that hadn't happened yet.
Resounding through Madison Square Garden. And I was kind of blown away. Like, holy shit, I wrote that kind of thing. That was one of the first times it really hit me, like, yeah, I got that Fish was growing and they were becoming a popular thing.
Right.
But something about being in Madison Square Garden and everyone singing along. That meant a lot. You know, I guess whenever they debut a song.
Well, that's what I mean. A lot of times the two of us are, I'm with the two of you when something's debuted and you'll start like talking to each other and laughing about, you know, a certain lyric that was just sung. And,
right.
And it's just got to be a rush. It's got to be really cool.
It's an incredible rush. And I think with Twitter now, people are very, very tuned into what are the new songs? What songs did they play at the last show? People are very, very on top of the set lists now. And with my tweeting, I think the unveiling of Mercury was one of the sort of the most recent examples of people really sort of lusting after.
Love that song.
Yeah, people lusting after a song and asking me and praising me about the complexity of the lyrics and that kind of thing. And is this sort of a not a departure, but sort of a hearkening back to Trey writing sort of multi-part songs kind of thing? All these questions I can't really answer. I do remember getting a lot of Twitter heat about Mercury in a good way.
I mean, part of the mythology, too, is that it was left off the album, and Trey and
Ezrin, I mean, Bob Ezrin.
Ezrin both were sad about that, but it didn't fit for some reason. But fans just went crazy for that. They just...
It kind of added to its legend in a way. Legend,
yeah.
There's songs that, you know, are part of Fish's canon that, for whatever reason, didn't make it onto albums. Mercury, I think, for whatever reason, you know, that particular album, I think, that you're talking about is Big Boat. And that one really, if you look at it from a satellite's view, that one was a very, very kind of an equitable album where the band was, every single one of them contributed a lot to that album. And I think putting a, you know, 8-9 minute sure. song when Trey already had, I think, 4 or 5 of his own songs on it would have displaced someone else's stuff.
Sure.
Yeah. But, you know, I guess the argument could be made that that song, why not just throw it on? Because it was a good song and it was part of that era. That was my argument. Like, why, you know, a CD can hold
right.
a lot of
it's
music.
It's not the album yeah. anymore where you had the...
There is a vinyl, I guess there is a vinyl contingent. These days,
yeah.
But who knows? I don't know. I was
Who
sad.
Cares? It made it more... Yeah. Desired.
Right. It, yeah, exactly. And yet, they didn't really play it.
A couple times, though. And that was definitely the one I was trying to think of earlier in San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
And it was so good.
Yeah.
You want to listen to that version of Mercury, San Francisco, last summer.
Yeah. I feel Mercury tells a story, you know, that just the word Mercury to me always, it evoked the god Mercury, who's the messenger god, and it evoked... one of the coolest elements in the world. It's metal that's liquid at room temperature, which is bizarre. And then it's a planet, which acts weird, where its day is longer than its year. And it also moves in retrograde, meaning if you look at it from the Earth, the combination of Earth's orbit and Mercury's orbit around the Sun makes it, at times, look like Mercury is moving backwards. And it's bizarre, and astronomers in the old days, until I think Copernicus or someone, Newton possibly even, finally figured it out, they actually thought that it was, you know, backing up here and there. Like, it would go pretty fast, and then it backed up, and then it would move, and then it would back up. And anyway.
Suddenly, Neil deGrasse Tyson just walked in.
Hey, Neil, how are you?
Scott, what is the Fish song that you helped write that you're most proud of, and why?
Specifically, why?
I don't know that I feel like pride specifically about any of the songs, just because, I don't know, I just don't have that in my personality, but I really enjoy hearing... Like you were talking about a little while ago, I really love hearing when the crowd is into something or when they're particularly receptive to something. It's very rewarding.
Totally.
I'm not sure if I describe it as pride, but it's definitely something that makes you feel good about having been part of that.
I think that's pride.
One of those things.
What songs?
Well, one of the things, like you mentioned, that you hear where the crowd responds is, I think it's in Limb by Limb, where you say, where they, everyone for some reason gets into the line that says, up or down, it's up to you.
Yeah.
Which is your line.
That's right, exactly. So
a Scott Herman line. Yeah.
And when I wrote it, I meant it a certain way that when I wrote it to you, and immediately when you first talked to me about it, you pointed out the fact that it could mean like something entirely different. I'm like, oh yeah. Well, I didn't realize right away because I meant it in kind of a straightforward way that it's your choice.
Up or down, it's up to you.
Right. It's your choice. You
and
can
I
do
meant
it. And when you read it, you interpreted it as up or down.
It's still
no
up.
No matter what, it's up to you. Yeah. That's how far down you are.
It's up, right. Exactly.
But now when I hear the crowd sing it, I don't know what they're thinking, but it's still great fun, right. You know, to hear it.
So that particular call and answer that you and I did, I mean, we didn't know that Trey was going to do a call and answer with Paige on that, but I think the fact that you and I wrote it as call and answer, and then that Paige and Trey sang it as call and answer, made it that much more poignant in a way, right? Because I was saying, like, I never want my hand cut off. Never want a hacking cough. Never need a cliffside push. Never turn my brain to mush. That was me.
Yeah.
And then you said.
And you said never, so I did always.
Yeah. Always give me what I lack. Always take the best parts back. Always recognize your fate.
Always just a moment late.
Just a moment late. And then I said, left is where I always turn. Left is how I'm forced to learn. Left.
The route
my walking takes, left alone with my mistakes. And then you, rather than go right, you went
up. Yeah, I did up against the person who, up till now, I never knew. Up from hell, the answer blew. Up or down, it's up to you.
It's up to you.
Never want my hand cut off.
Never want
I need a cliffside push.
Never turn my brain to mush.
Always give me what I lack.
Always take the best parts back.
Always recognize your fate.
Always just a moment late.
Left is where I always turn.
Left is how I'm forced to learn.
Left the route my walking takes.
Left alone with my mistakes.
Up against a person who,
up till now, I never knew.
Up from hell, the answer blew.
Up or down, it's up to you.
Drop me off the Chinese wall.
And that was one of those where Trey probably mined the prints and found the Chinese Wall lyrics from another poem.
So completely. Trey wrote that part?
Yeah.
Because that whole drop me off the Chinese wall. I've had so many people tell me how much they love that lyric.
Yeah. No, I think I think that part was Tom, but from another.
From a different poem in the
prose. Oh, okay.
Like those
and peel my fingers off the rim.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those four lewd while in mid-air and land to.
Yeah, I definitely wrote that, but I think it was in a different song.
Okay.
Yeah. But Trey sort of sometimes just because he's a Jedi and sometimes just randomly can put two things together and it works tremendously well. Sometimes he'll put two things together that I sort of, you know, don't look back in anger. look back in anger and say, why did he do that? But, you know, for the most part, he always kind of, whenever he does one of those, like, you know, merges, no one knows.
Most of the time it works.
And most of the time it works.
A lot of times he just grabs
that notebook and opens it up and will never know that was a merge.
Until now.
Yeah.
Damn it.
So let's just really quickly, we've done probably enough to do a podcast episode, but really quickly, let's talk about the first festival. So Phish announced Clifford Ball. It was 1996.
And who knew what to expect?
Right there.
And we didn't know what to
expect. August 16th and 17th, 96, because I have the original poster mounted on the wall.
In Plattsburgh. And all we knew was it was a decommissioned Air Force base way the hell up in New York State.
So nice rural area of New York.
So the Clifford Ball was announced for August 16th and 17th in 1996. And this was our foray into
the whole, like, we've gone on road trips before for Fish. Obviously, it's 96. We've been doing it since the 80s.
The three of us in particular.
Yeah.
And so,
but the whole idea of getting an RV and going and setting things up.
And taking time multiple
bringing
days.
Bringing our bikes.
Right. And so the three of us, we, I guess.
Big outdoor festival with just Fish.
Right.
Right. And so.
And not knowing what to expect whatsoever.
Right.
We went in blind.
But what we did know was that Fish had promised us
a place to park the RV right backstage amongst the buses.
Right. Exactly. You know, that's where we were actually right with the band.
That's right. That's right. And was that the one where we made special IDs?
No.
And promised a party?
Yes.
A cocktail party?
I have it right over there, I thought.
That was for the Went, I'm pretty sure.
It's right here.
We didn't know what was going on. We weren't prepared for the Clifford Ball to be what it was.
So anyway, we got a RV, and we drove up to Plattsburgh. Who was in the RV with us?
We picked up Brad on the way.
We had our friend Brad Smith with us.
Yeah, we picked him up in Saratoga or something.
Yeah. No.
So is the
yes.
So Saratoga? And then the four of us drove in, and at that point, we parked and we were really close to the band enclave.
And next to
right next to the stage, and at that point, didn't Trey kind of pick us up and give us a tour?
Yes, you're right. So Trey took us to show us the grounds because they were so amazing. And we came in the back way, so we never saw the grounds coming in.
Right.
And it was the day before, so they hadn't even sound checked yet.
Right.
And that's when Trey took us in the famous little double. We had two golf carts.
Yeah.
Danny Clinch happened to be on one of them.
Right. Danny Clinch, the photographer, was on one, and he was photographing us speeding down the runway. Speeding down the runway.
But into
The campgrounds.
Not the campgrounds, but the actual where the Ferris wheel was and the all the little city was and the post office. And he was showing, he was so pumped.
The venue.
And so excited.
Trey was part of this, the reason that Fish festivals were so incredible was because of the way that they created this amazing venue that not only sort of it was its own city, so to speak, but they also made the places where people are living. They had streets and they had post offices and
general store.
They had a store and
people on
people were provided for. And yes, entertainers kind of came
through everywhere all weekend.
And it was like
gliders,
a circus carnival atmosphere, but
it was
a pleasant
one. Most of that was organic.
Yeah.
Well, and they would learn from it. So the second festival, things got better because the first festival there weren't enough toilets.
And believe
second festival, overkill,
too many toilets,
which there never is such a thing. So in Trey's exuberance, do you remember this? So we're flying down, and we go to the. He's so excited when we go into the campground, and then he sees the Ferris wheel, and he says, let's go to the Ferris wheel.
Oh, yeah.
We go to the Ferris wheel, and he literally flipped a switch.
Oh, yeah.
And the thing lit
up. Oh, yeah.
And started to go, and we were like, so excited, and then it was like panic. Like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
The whole thing lit up. Like, it lit up the whole ground.
I think Trey may have even started some engine.
Yes.
There was, like, a generator.
Yes.
And, like, you know, I think he pressed a switch, and nothing happened. And then he was like, oh, I get it. And then he kind of, like, pushed some foot switch.
Right.
And all of a sudden, there was this, like,
and then like the music,
like a diesel engine
the music
started.
Went off, the carnival music,
the carnival
and then the
music
lights came on.
The lights on the carnival, and then there are these complex gears, sort of that was all run by this one large lever. And Trey pulled it, and the whole carnival, the whole Ferris wheel moved one step forward. And then we decided, let's get the F out of here.
And so we escaped. And this was the best part. As we were escaping, we go into the campgrounds.
Oh,
and there's people camping all over the place.
Right.
They're already there.
We were driving. So at this point, the other golf cart had left us. And it was you, me, and Trey, Tebow.
Right.
And I'm not sure where Scott was. But I remember Trey driving.
Right, he
was up the wheel. I was the passenger.
And I was
and
hanging
I think you
on
were in the back.
Back,
and I'm not positive if you were there.
He might have been.
Scott, Trey pulled up to a tent, and we'd already gone through sort of, you know, when someone sees Trey, they're like, oh my God, that's Trey.
Right.
But it was late at night.
Yeah, everyone was, it was quiet except for us.
Quiet except for us. And Trey pulled up to a tent, and unzipped it. And what did he say?
He just unzipped it, unzipped the fly, unzipped the main screen, and poked his head in and screamed, concert's canceled. Go home. And they, the look on their faces as they like came out of deep sleep, would bolt up and just their, I don't even know if they knew it was Trey. It was just someone screaming at them to go home. And, but the thing was, we did it 3 or 4 times.
Right.
And I think there, so there's kids out there. Someone's Trey out was there. In there. I don't know if they ever knew it.
There's
was
people out there that have been traumatized.
Yeah,
by Trey,
a redhead,
and they're not positive that it really.
I think
happened.
That's why I abandoned you guys, because I knew you were about to get a fix.
Exactly.
Now, did the flatbed show happen at the Great Went first, or was that?
I think it was Clifford Ball.
Was that a Clifford Ball?
We have all those pictures of us on bikes going next to it.
That was the first one.
So yeah,
and we just rode our bikes next to him, and then now it's 4 a.m. Even we all got, I don't know what time it was, but it was late. It was early morning.
So we knew
people were sound asleep.
We had the word to expect something crazy. And to get the bikes.
Well, remember, they put the whole thing together backstage, and then we just got on our bikes and just followed them.
Exactly.
It was really cool.
They had
no one bothered.
They had the entire band set up on a flatbed truck. They drove the flatbed through the camp.
Playing just this great.
They just did sort of an ambient jam,
and people would get up and follow
the truck
or go back to bed.
It was me, Scott, and Tebow on bikes. Right behind the truck. So they were kind of playing to us.
Until it got too crowded.
And then we
peeled off.
Then we peeled off and went to sleep. Yeah, we saw enough. That was great. Yeah, sleep. So, to speak. Of course, then we went to festival number 2, the Great Went. And that's where the picture from this episode, this podcast episode on my website, underthescales.com, is from. And we had a flag that we sort of had a flag raising ceremony, and it kind of turned into an Iwo Jima kind of flag raising situation where Danny Clinch took a picture of us all pushing the flag up.
On top of our RV.
This time we got to drive up in our cars, and they had a trailer for us also in the sort of band family area.
Right.
And that was wonderful. But this, because this time we had something called a Tom Marshall cocktail party or something along those lines, this was the beginning of our getting banned from the immediate inner circle.
Although they were all four of them.
They all
our
came
parties.
To the party,
yeah.
But it sort of became a thing, I think, like along around 4 o'clock, I think, you know, Paige or Mike or someone wanted to go to sleep. And sleep wasn't available based on what was happening. We had Gordon Stone playing.
Band playing. We had a full bar. We had masseuses, jugglers.
And then I remember at one point power went out, like a huge generator ran out of gas, and the party was right in full swing, and they all gathered around us in a ring and shined their lights into the party, and so the party kept going.
And that could have been on Bittersweet Motel, but it's been recorded because they were there.
Yeah.
The film crew was there.
You're right.
So it was recorded, but it didn't make the movie.
Yeah, so Todd Phillips had become our friend and had walked with us through many, many, you know...
Shows prior.
Yes. We went to Europe with Todd Phillips and went to, lots of shows. And this was sort of the sort of culmination where... I guess he was going to take this footage and then create the movie. And we were kind of excited that our party backstage had Gordon Stone playing and had Todd Phillips filming. Yeah. And
So it's in there somewhere. It's in the Fish archives.
It's in the archives. It didn't make the movie. The only thing that made the movie with me in it at all is I think I walked by and say something silly to Trey just one time. You walk I think by it's in the middle something. Of when he's...
We all walk by. You're in it. We, the three of us walk by. Trey's talking.
Trey's arguing with,
I think with that girl.
Right. And it's that scene where some girl he didn't know.
Yeah, he didn't have any idea what she was saying.
Accosts
she was
him. Like, she's all fucked up.
Right.
And she's trying to sort of say, don't you remember? And he's like, I don't. What do you mean?
And he's like, I got to go.
It's uncomfortable.
But anyway, that was that would be so fun someday to see some of that footage.
Yeah, we have to find that footage. Anyway, we've gone on way too long here. Nice to be with you guys, Stephen and Scott, and let's have a couple more in the future at the behest and request of the fans. Thank you very much. Under the Scales. See you next week. Goodbye.